Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Julia Barnes. She's an award-winning documentary filmmaker. She's the director of Sea of Life and Bright Green Lies. Her current work focuses on opposing deep-sea mining. So, first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
And before we start, I just want to say to listeners that you have long been one of my heroes. I remember the first time you interviewed me, I don't know how many years ago, and you were at the time so young and yet so smart. And any hope that I have for the future comes through people like you. So I just wanted to say that in public.
Oh, thank you so much. You're one of my heroes as well.
Well, thank you. Okay, so let's talk about what is deep sea mining? Probably a lot of people have not heard of it.
Yeah, a lot of people haven't heard of it. So deep sea mining, there's, you know, different types that have been proposed because there are so many different kind of regions in the ocean. So there are three main areas that they're interested potentially in mining. There are hydrothermal vents, there are cobalt crusts, and there are abyssal plains that have polymetallic nodules on them. So the main area that they're currently looking at mining, the place they'll be starting first, is the abyssal plains. So in that case, I mean, this is all theoretical at this point. Like, deep sea mining in international waters has not begun yet. So at this stage, these are just plans, but the plans that they have are, they will have a ship that goes out. They will lower a machine onto the seabed.
Wait, can we back up a second? Mm-hmm. You're using a lot of terms that people might not know. Can you back up a little bit? What is an abyssal plane, and what are the manganese nodules? What can you define both of those, please?
Sure, definitely. So the abyssal plains are like an area of the deep sea that is very flat. It's characterized by long stretching flat plains with very silty sediment and scattering of things called polymetallic nodules. And polymetallic nodules are really cool, actually. We can go into some detail about these. How they form is, starts off with something like a fragment of debris on the seafloor, so oftentimes a shark tooth. And then over millions of years, metals from the seawater amalgamate around these fragments. And so polymetallic nodules contain various metals, things like manganese, iron, nickel, copper, and cobalt. Although, you know, mining companies like to say they're a battery in a rock, it's really only less than 3% of the makeup of these polymetallic nodules that are the nickel, the copper, and the cobalt that they're kind of going after for batteries. So it's a fairly small percentage of them. A lot of it, if they did mine them, would be just waste material. But anyway, polymetallic nodules are very porous. They have about 60% porosity, and they are home to incredible communities of microbes. So the microbial communities on a polymetallic nodule are much more diverse and much more dense than what exists in the surrounding sediment. And so the microbes live on and inside these nodules, and they actually play a pretty important role in the carbon cycle. So they pull carbon out of the surrounding seawater, and through a redox reaction using some of the manganese in the nodules, they will sequester that carbon and deposit it into the sediments below the nodules. So polymetallic nodules are these things that, you know, some studies have looked in. We don't know too much about them, obviously. Like, the deep sea is very far removed, and it hasn't been studied much, but there have been some studies looking at the fact that these nodules like regulate the nutrient contents of the chemistry of the water around them. So they are very key to the community in the abyssal plains. They're also often the only hard substrate that species can attach to. So corals or sponges will grow on them. They're breeding ground for different species. They're really important habitat.
So before we move on, can you talk, I got a question about the nodules and then a larger question about the ecology of the region. The nodules is, how big are they? Are they like the size of a grape or the size of a cannonball? I guess cannonball doesn't really mean anything anymore. Or, and can you talk about the larger, you mentioned sponges and corals. What is the ecology of those regions like? So first, size of the nodules. Second, what's the ecology like?
So the size of the nodules, the diameter is like 2 to 4 inches. That could be a typical nodule. They kind of range in size. Some of them are much smaller. Some of them are bigger. Mining companies often call them potato-sized. So that should give people a sense. And then, yeah, the ecology of the abyssal plains. You can find like the typical species that people think of when they think of the ocean. So fish and corals and sponges and crabs and jellyfish and starfish. There are urchins. There are benthic invertebrates who live inside the sediment. So you wouldn't see them if you watched footage of the deep sea, but there are whole communities inside the sediment as well. And yeah, there's sharks, there's eels, there are species that people are familiar with, but there's also like really cool just different adaptations and species who look so different than anything we're used to. It's just a very amazing biodiverse world down there. And I mean, life is more spread out. It's not like there's a high amount of biomass necessarily in the deep sea, but there is a high amount of biodiversity.
I'm just making this up, but I'll bet that if you include bacteria, that there actually would be a fair amount of biomass down there.
Yeah, that's true. They don't usually get counted, I guess.
Okay, so now you started to talk about mining before I interrupted you.
Sure. So the process that they're planning, the mining machines that they're planning on lowering down into the seafloor are going to be really huge. The one that is like closest to getting started, it would be 40 feet long, 20 feet wide, and 16 feet tall. So I've heard these described as house-sized machines, and that's absolutely accurate. They're quite big. These machines would move along the seafloor and pick up these polymetallic nodules. I'm not sure pick up is the right word, like suction them up, scrape them up off the seafloor. And of course, this is going to bring with it noise and light pollution and things that are really disruptive to species in the deep sea. Everyone in the deep sea has evolved to live in a world with no light, and so they depend on bioluminescence and sound to be able to communicate and find food. And so this alone is really disruptive. On top of that, these machines will be kicking up a whole bunch of sediment. Even when scientists send down like rovers to look at the deep sea, when they land on the seafloor, you can sometimes see these huge clouds of sediment forming around them. And you know, when you have these huge machines moving along the seafloor, it's going to stir up sediment, which will bury and smother different organisms. A lot of the species in the deep sea are not very mobile, so it's not like they can just run away from this. And of course, there'll be species who get sucked into the mining machines. Another thing that's important to understand is that the deep sea is the largest active carbon sink on Earth. So stirring up sediment is going to release carbon back into the water, and it could actually increase the acidity of the deep sea. which could be a huge problem. I mean, we know ocean acidification is a really big deal for shellfish and coral reefs and different species who live in the upper layers of the ocean, and this could become a really big problem in the deep sea as well. So then at depth, they're planning on crushing these nodules and then sending the crushed material along with whatever else they've sucked up, like sediments and stuff, back up to a ship on the sea surface. So on the ship, they'll do some initial processing to separate the crushed nodules from the sediments. And then they're going to be left with some wastewater that has, like, you know, debris and sediment, and they're going to pump that back down into the ocean. And we don't know exactly where, but it'll probably be somewhere in the midwater zone, the mesopelagic zone, between 200 meters and 1,000 meters deep. And this is, again, going to cause a whole lot of problems for this whole other area of the ocean. So it's fine particulate matter. It gets into the gills of fish. It damages their ability to breathe. It could disrupt plankton because it changes the lighting conditions and the nutrient contents. And it's just this huge change to the ocean. There are some estimates that each mining vessel would release 2 to 6 million cubic feet of sediment per day. So to give you a sense of scale, that's like 22,000 dump trucks full of sediment being released into the ocean every day from every mining vessel. And there are many different mining sites that are being planned. So there are also currents in the water column that, so it would take the sediment on a pretty far journey. I mean, it will impact an area so much larger than the area that's being mined. And something that's important to know about this sediment as well is that it's very fine material. A lot of it has to do with, like, marine fall, marine snow, like detritus that has been broken down. It's not like sand, and it's not just going to sink and resettle, but it could stay suspended in the water for anywhere from 3 months to several years. So it's a really long-term problem as well.
And I don't remember if you mentioned this in the interview or if this was in the film that you sent me to watch, that the creatures who live down in the abyssal plain, many of them grow very slowly and are very long lived. So,
yes, I didn't mention that yet. Yeah, they have incredible lifespans. Some corals can live for 3,000 to 4,000 years, and sponges up to 11,000 years. So, yeah, very old, long-lived species. And yeah, life kind of operates on different time scales in the deep sea. It's a very cold environment. It's like 36 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Celsius. So yeah, it's kind of different conditions down there.
So when you kill a sponge who's 11,000 years old, you're killing someone who is 2 to 3 times, who has been alive 2 to 3 times longer than civilization itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're killing someone who is 10 to 12 times or 6 to 12 times as old as a pretty old growth tree.
Mm-hmm.
And if you smother them, presumably... I believe sponges are filter feeders, are they not? So if you smother them with sediment, they will probably die.
Oh yeah.
But the people who are pushing this idea are actually environmentalists. I mean, they're actually environmental saviors, right?
Yeah, that's what they like to call themselves. Yeah, the companies who are doing this have gotten very clever with their PR campaigns. And they love to put themselves out as the heroes for the environment. They have these, like, advertising videos, and it shows an electric car driving down the road. And so they like to talk about the idea that these metals are going to be really necessary for a transition to clean and renewable energy and batteries for electric cars. And they really mischaracterize the deep sea when they talk about their mining as well. They talk about it as a lifeless desert, and they call deep sea mining like one of the gentlest forms of mining. Also, something that they've done, I think maybe very smartly in their PR, is that they've they're always making the comparison between deep sea mining and land mining. So they like to say, like, oh, we can deforest the Amazon and have child labor mining on land, or we can mine the deep sea and it'll be so much better. And of course, this is all based on a false, like, it's a fallacy that if you mine in the deep sea, there would be any less mining taking place on land. And if demand for these metals is really growing to the extent that they're predicting it will, it's not like mining operations on land are all of a sudden just going to close up because someone started mining in the deep sea. It's really an expansion of mining into a whole new area that's extremely fragile.
So one, interviewers are not supposed to ask questions to which they have no idea the answer, but I'm going to ask this, and if you don't know the answer, that's okay. How does it compare cost-wise to mining on land? I'm presuming this is more expensive.
Yeah, I have no idea the comparison of that. It is tremendously expensive to mine in the deep sea. But I don't know, they're expecting to get really high returns as well. They evaluated nodules as being like $200 to $400 per ton of nodule. And I think that per ton of polymetallic nodules, sorry. And I think that might be quite exaggerated because they tend to use higher numbers for the concentrations of metals that they'll find in these nodules than what I found in other studies. But there are 30 billion tons of polymetallic nodules in the Clarion-Clipperton zone alone. So.
And what is that zone? I don't know what that means.
That's the area where they're planning on mining to start with. It's probably the area with the highest concentration of polymetallic nodules. So yeah, it's an abyssal plains region between Hawaii and Mexico. And it's a very large area. If all the mines that are being planned for the Clarion-Clipperton zone go ahead, it would be an area as long as the continental United States is wide.
I think that's a pretty small sacrifice zone.
Yeah, we could do that. Trade off, you know?
So let's back up again. And when you say nodules on the seafloor, and they're 2 to 4 inches, like, what would be a typical concentration? Is there one nodule every foot or one nodule every mile? I mean, how concentrated are the nodules?
There could be several nodules every foot. They can be very concentrated in areas. Now, I don't know what the average concentration would be. Like, I've just seen images and videos of certain areas of the ocean. I don't really know. They can be very concentrated in some areas. They can also be more spread out.
And what does when I watched your video, there's something I didn't really understand. What does the island nation of Nauru have to do with this?
Oh, yeah. So Nauru recently invoked something that is colloquially known as the 2-year rule. It's this part of the international law of the sea that says that basically they're putting an ultimatum on the International Seabed Authority coming up with regulations for deep sea mining and allowing it to begin in international waters. So if they haven't come up with regulations in 2 years, they have to, you know, consider and probably issue a provisional license for this company, Nori, from Nauru. It's called Nori. It's called, that's the acronym. It's called Nauru Ocean Resources, Inc., I believe. So they would have to allow them to start mining. And that opens it up for anyone to start mining at that point. So they triggered this rule on June 25th, 2021. So mining the deep sea in international waters could begin as soon as 2023.
And so Nauru is in favor of deep sea mining because they have this company there. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, their government is anyway. I don't know how the people feel about it.
Yes.
But yeah, they are. This company is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Metals Company, which is a Canadian-based corporation. But they're working with the government in Nauru. I guess they've probably promised them that they'll bring in lots of revenue.
And that would not be mining near Nauru, would it? Because you said that's over east of Hawaii. I'm sorry, right. west of Hawaii. No, east of,
yes,
Hawaii, I mean.
Yeah.
And so it would be a Canadian company run through Nauru destroying the ocean between Hawaii and the Americas.
Yep.
Okay. But they are, there is not a consensus among island people that this mining would be good, that there is opposition among many people in the island nations. Is that correct?
Right. So this would obviously affect a lot of people if this mining goes ahead, because, yeah, the region that they're mining and the distance that these sediment plumes could travel, a lot of Pacific Islanders are very concerned about the impact that deep sea mining would have on them and are speaking out against deep sea mining.
And so you said this a little bit. Can you talk a little bit more about the legality that currently it is illegal for anybody to mine to do this deep sea mining, correct?
Yeah, they can't do deep sea mining in international waters. Any country could mine within their economic exclusive zone around their country, but not in international waters.
And is that happening anywhere?
I believe it's only happened for diamond mining so far. Yeah, that's the only one that I'm aware of.
And sorry to go so far afield, but what we know that a lot of the fishing in the ocean is illegal. What's to stop mining companies from just doing it anyway if it's economically in their interest?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Nothing. I mean, on the high seas, this is not a policeable area. So it could already be going on illegally, you know, like I wouldn't know. Would anything stop them? I have no idea. They could totally start mining illegally. And we see so much illegal fishing going on, like almost half of the fishing that takes place is illegal fishing. I think it's like 40% or something, 44%. So, I mean, I guess the issue with deep sea mining is that so much money has to go into it. It's not like fishing, you just need to have a boat, right? But they have to raise a lot of funds. So maybe that would keep them from doing it illegally. Like, a mining company. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I don't really know the answer to this.
Oh, I was just going to say something sort of silly, which is that this has always seemed to me to be one of the, if you're going to have a Navy, it would seem to me that this would be a primary use of it is to, if you find somebody mining in the, you know, doing deep sea mining or illegal fishing, you go in and capture the crew and then sink the ship. But leaving that aside, can you just briefly touch on the two other forms? You know, you mentioned them very, very quickly, and I'd never heard of them before. The ocean vent mining, and I don't remember the other one.
Okay, yeah. So hydrothermal vents are one of the areas that they're interested in mining, and I think it's for slightly different substances there. I haven't done a whole lot of research into these two other types of mining because the focus right now is so much on the polymetallic nodules. But yeah, mining hydrothermal vents would be a bit more complicated. It's not like just nodules that are scattered on the seafloor and that are fairly easy to pick up. They would have to be breaking up the like rock formations on the hydrothermal vents in order to get at that, and then be, the same kind of process in terms of transporting it back to a ship on the surface and all that. And then the other one is cobalt crusts on seamounts, which is kind of like a similar situation. They would have to be breaking them up with machines. Originally, the hydrothermal vents were something that companies were looking at. Like before, it was the metals company, which is the main one pushing for deep sea mining right now. It was called Deep Green Metals, and before that, it was called, well, it's not technically the same company, but a lot of the same people were involved in a company called Nautilus. And Nautilus in Papua New Guinea was looking at mining hydrothermal vents around Papua New Guinea. And they had these huge machines back then with these like spike-looking things that were meant to be, yeah, breaking up hydrothermal vents, basically.
There's something especially obscene, it seems to me, about mining or destroying hydrothermal vents, especially given that at least some theories I've heard are that hydrothermal vents are could have been one of the sort of gardens of Eden on this planet in terms of places where life first began. It's just especially horrifying to me. And also, I mean, jumping to the larger picture on all this, it's so clear that unless this culture is stopped, it will kill everything on the planet.
Yeah, and hydrothermal vents are so amazing. Like the temperatures there are 700 degrees Fahrenheit or like 370 degrees Celsius, and there are species who can live in that kind of environment. And so there are like two worms. There are these ones called Yeti crabs, and they're really cute because they have this kind, they're white crabs, and they've got all these hairs on their body, and they stay in this warm temperature water, and they grow things like algae on the hairs on their body, and then they eat off of those hairs, so they're like farming on themselves to feed themselves. And yeah, there's just these amazing communities there. And actually, I think that's one of the reasons that companies have kind of moved away from looking at mining hydrothermal vents, at least for the time being, is because people have really recognized how beautiful and unique they are. And, there's a lot of outcry against mining on hydrothermal vents, whereas it's a lot easier for these companies to show images of the abyssal plains and say, oh, this just looks like a desert, and not people to freak out so much about the fact that they're going to be going down there and mining in that area.
Can you really hammer, go back to the releasing of the sediment in the mid zone of the ocean and really, I mean, you said it's a lot would be released. And you already said this, but can you hit it again? I don't know. I really want for people to get an idea of what it would be like to have a bunch of sediment dumped on your head. I mean, this is going to be, I mean, whales swim through there. Everybody swims through there. And can you talk a little bit more about the effects? You know, you did say it'll get in their gills, make it hard to breathe. But I mean, let's just be pretty blunt. I mean, first off, on land, you know, I grew up in Colorado and there are, there was, you know, big gold rushes in the 19th century, or big rushes in the 19th century, mining rushes. And I remember when I was a kid being up on tailings piles that still have no plants growing on them at all. Mm-hmm. And that was 100 years later. And this would be essentially the same thing, is you're disturbing all the sediment and then dumping back out your mine waste. Can you hit that a little bit harder?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, nobody's ever done this before, but I assume a lot of fish won't survive. Like, if they're swimming in these mining plumes, they just won't be able to breathe, right? And others, if it's less concentrated, maybe it'll damage their breathing. But yeah, this is a really important area. There are so many different species of fish who live there. Whales feed in the area. The Clarion-Clipperton Zone is quite near something called the White Shark Cafe, where white sharks come to feed, great white sharks come to feed on squid. And, you know, on top of this, everything in the ocean is so connected. Like, species are always migrating through this area, and there is a migration that takes place every day between the depths of the ocean and the surface, the diovertical migration, the largest mass migration on Earth. And, you know, there are just so many different species who will be trying to swim through this sediment. It's really disastrous. Like, I can't even put into words how bad this will be for the ocean. And, you know, this is on top of everything else that the ocean is already facing, like the huge depletion of fish populations, the warming of the ocean, the acidification, and to add this whole other threat that is really disturbing something so fundamental to the functioning of the ocean, and this is going to affect this huge area. It's just one of the worst things that I could imagine.
And in the short film you sent me, one of the people you interviewed was talking about this could be the thing that pushes the oceans over toward pretty much complete collapse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I don't think that's any exaggeration. You know, we don't know, and a thing that scientists often talk about when it comes to deep sea mining is, like, we don't know what the impacts will be, because this is so, we've never had this amount of sediment being thrown into the ocean. We've never had, you know, the deep sea is something that is talked about as being largely undisturbed by humans, and the sediment doesn't get stirred up. Like, it's been so protected from this kind of thing. And I won't say that the deep sea is entirely undisturbed. I think a big problem in all this, and something that I'm really critical of, is, you know, they'll go in and do baseline studies and look at the deep sea, and marine snow has to be so much less than what it used to be, like, just with the depletion of the ocean and all the upper layers. And we know that there's microplastics in the deep sea, so it's not like it's entirely unimpacted. I think the nutrients that are making it to the deep sea are probably a lot less than what they used to be. And I think that when they do baseline studies, they're not really getting a true sense of what amount of fecundity there should be in the deep sea. But the disturbance that would be caused by deep sea mining is just on a whole other level in terms of scale. And I don't know, like, we can't let this happen.
I think that your point about the snow is incredibly important. And I remember reading, you know, I've mentioned for years that there used to be flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darkened the sky for days at a time. And when they would roost in favored trees or favored parts of the forest, they might roost there for a little while, you know, a week or two, and then move on to somewhere else. And when they would leave, the ground would look like it would be covered with snow because of all the bird poop. And it's the same with fish, that if you have depleted the oceans of, you know, I don't know what the numbers are on the biomass of fish in the oceans who have been removed. But if you remove, I don't know, let's just say 60% of the biomass, 50%, 70%, 80%, that's obviously going to be removing 80% of the poop to fall down and 80% of the body mass to eventually fall down.
Yeah, exactly. I think the deep sea is quite starved of nutrients at this point. And I would be so curious to find out what it was like before. But of course, there aren't records of that. So it's really, yeah.
And this is a real side note, but it's you mentioned something else that I don't think people know about, which is, even though it's the largest migration on the planet, can you talk about that vertical migration? Just introduce people to that, because I think it's incredibly fascinating. And again, I think probably, you know, most of the listeners don't really know about it.
Yeah, it is very fascinating. So it's kind of this idea that there's predator chasing prey up the water column, and, you know, creatures travel from the depths to the surface to feed because, of course, there's plankton up there. And then, you know, you have smaller fish, you have larval fish, you have all these species moving, you know, up to the surface. And the reason they do this at night is because then they can escape visual predation. And then you get just like larger species following all these smaller species who are moving. So there's this huge migration of species every single night, you know, going from the deep ocean to the surface layers of the ocean. And some species wait at the depths and try to ambush their prey when they're coming back down. Yeah, it's just really interesting, this whole, I mean, there's a bunch of different species that do this, like squid and lanternfish and jellies and, you know, copepods. Just, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit more about efforts to oppose it? You've mentioned, so talk about your work and then also talk about the work of anybody else who is trying to oppose it, and what are they doing?
Mm-hmm. The IUCN recently called for a moratorium. That was a pretty major newsworthy thing. There was a statement by 500 marine scientists calling for a moratorium on deep sea mining, which is also a pretty big deal, particularly because scientists who study the deep sea tend to be dependent on mining companies to get out on their boats. It's very expensive to get on a boat and do research in the deep sea, so they're often working with industry. So to have that many marine scientists, you know, take the risk to their careers of making a statement on this is kind of a big deal. And there have been, you know, attempts to petition the International Seabed Authority. These are the kind of things that people have been trying. I mean, of course, nothing has worked so far. And it's really all up to the International Seabed Authority to, like, they're the ones who've been put in charge of this. And I think the legitimacy of that should be challenged. Like, why is this organization given the authority to regulate the international seabed? I could talk a bit about the ISA. They've received a lot of criticism for.
Oh, that would be great if you did. I know absolutely nothing about that organization. Who's in it? Where does it get its funding? To whom does it owe its allegiance?
Yeah, it's a UN body. It's based in Jamaica. They are the ones who are in charge of, they were given a dual mandate when they were created. So one of them was to protect the international seabed, and then the other one was to permit mining of the international seabed. So right off the bat, there's a huge conflict there. And their allegiance seems to be towards mining. The way that they're meant to derive their funding is by selling mining permits and by getting revenues from mining royalties. So very much biased towards mining. And the Secretary General of the International Seabed Authority has allowed himself to be filmed for a promotional video for a mining company. So the metals company, back when it was called Deep Green, he was on their boat and wearing their hard hat with their logo on his forehead. And, you know, this is the Secretary General of an organization that is meant to be regulating these companies, appearing in their promotional video and like saying lines for them to promote their business. So there's that.
And let's say that the International Seabed Authority gives permission and makes some sort of crappy regulations. Is there any authority that can be appealed to? Like, if that were to happen within the United States, if the Forest Service issues a bad ruling, you can try to take them to court and you may end up, you know, at district court or even the Supreme Court. Is there anybody that oversees the International Seabed Authority? Let's say they put out regs that are just very favorable to mining and very bad for the oceans. What would be the options then?
Yeah, I have no idea. And that's something that I'm kind of looking into and trying to figure out. Like the group that I recently formed and am a part of, it's we're looking into how to challenge this legally. I don't even know what jurisdiction this would be in. Like, presumably you could go to the UN because it is a UN organization, the International Seabed Authority, but I don't know where they would stand on this. Like, they're probably happy with what the ISA is doing.
So who so tell me more about the organization that you've formed.
Yeah, it's called Deep Sea Defenders. And it's pretty new. It's just a small group of us who really care about stopping deep sea mining. So we meet every 1 or 2 weeks. And yeah, we're working on several things. One of the first things we did was put out a call for people to submit comments to the environmental impact statement of NORI, like an exploratory mining thing that they're about to be going ahead with. And, you know, not really thinking that that was going to solve the problem, but it was, you know, we had to weed through this whole long impact statement and look for flaws and kind of just going on the basis of, you know, if we can sow some seeds of doubt. I mean, I know that some of these small island nations who were lured in by these big mining companies, you know, promising to bring in a lot of money, are starting to get kind of scared because, you know, who's going to be held liable if something goes wrong with deep sea mining? So I think some of them are starting to second guess. So anyways, we that was our first effort, and we're planning some other things right now as well. And, you know, looking into trying to legally challenge, you know, even the legitimacy of Nauru to trigger the two-year rule, because it should have been that it was a Nauruan company, but this is a company that was a wholly owned subsidiary of a Canadian company, and they didn't have any Nauruan people apparently involved in it when they triggered the 2 year rule. So that the legitimacy of them even bringing that could be potentially challenged.
And how do people find out more information about your organization?
They can look us up. We have like a Facebook and a Twitter. We don't even have a website yet. So Deep Sea Defenders on Facebook or Twitter is probably the best way to find out about us.
And if anybody who cares about this, how can they help out both? Well, I have two questions. First one is how can somebody help you, or if they want to become a part of this effort, what do they do?
Yeah, they can just send us an email. I mean, we're definitely happy for more people to join the organization and help in terms of just like volunteering and doing things that need to be done. But helping in a general sense, yeah, like if people have certain skills. I mean, there are a few other good organizations also that are working on deep sea mining issues. There's one called the Deep Sea Mining Campaign in Australia, and Mining Watch Canada. There's some great people there who are working on this as well. So yeah, joining an organization is probably the best thing somebody can do, because as a group, you have a lot more power than if you're just one person trying to do something about this. So yeah, that's what I would recommend to start.
So, and we have about 5 minutes left, and I'm wondering, one of the things I try to hammer in all of these interviews, and you're like the perfect example of this, is I really want for people to move from, oh gosh, things are bad, to, and what can I do? And then we just, you know, watch more television or something, and to actually doing something. But what was it about you? I mean, how old were you when you first interviewed me for Sea of Life?
I don't know. I might have been like 17 or 18.
So how did you, what was it that made you, I mean, that's how we met, is you and your mom came here, yep, to Crescent City to interview me about for Sea of Life. Mm-hmm. And so what was it about you and your mom, actually, that caused you, that made the difference between you, like the rest of us, going, oh gosh, things are bad, I hate what's going on, and then actually like traveling internationally and doing this important work that you've been doing? How did you get off your butt? That's the question.
I've been trying to figure that out, actually, because for a long time I thought, it just has to be the information. Like, the story for me was I watched a documentary and learned about what was happening to the planet. And, you know, as soon as it was finished, I was like, oh, I have to do something about this. This is what I'm going to dedicate my life to. And then a week later, I was making a documentary. So it was just, I don't know, really fast for me. But I always loved the natural world and just, I guess, really didn't have a sense for most of my life of how much wrong was going on, how under assault it was. And when I found out, I just wanted to do something, and then it was just a matter of learning as I went along. And but I don't know what the difference is, like why some people don't react that way. Obviously not everybody does to the information. I might have just grown up with a greater sense of agency, and I don't know, not realizing that I couldn't change the world, you know? I don't know. I thought, if I'm not going to do something about this, it doesn't look like anybody else is, and it was too important to ignore.
And if you don't mind me asking, you know, I mentioned your mom, you know, and she brought you here. I mean, it seems to me your mom, and I've known three young filmmakers, one guy and one male and two females, all of whom went with a parent on doing their journeys. And so your mom must have been very supportive.
Yeah, I have the best mom in the world, for sure. Yeah, she just like went on this journey with me. I mean, she saw the same film that inspired me and just obviously saw how that impacted me. And yeah, she was very supportive. I mean, she let me do this crazy thing that most people don't do, and that obviously there's so much social pressure against it. Like, you're meant to go this traditional route. And she came along and, you know, watched and listened in on all these interviews I was doing. And I think she was constantly surprised by what she was learning as well. And yeah, I just felt the same about these things. Like,
So that's another thing that people can do, is people can, A, get off their butt and do some work, and also, B, if you're a parent, you can support your kid if your kid decides to get off his or her butt and do some work.
Yeah, that's really important, for sure.
And then I just have to ask, and this is a trivial question in some ways. What was the documentary that you both saw? I mean, I want to give a shout out to that particular person because, you know, your work is amazing. And if they this must have been amazing for them to make a documentary that a week later you're starting to do this great work.
Yeah, it's called Revolution. It's a film by Rob Stewart.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay, so the last thing is, this isn't so much about deep sea mining, but about anything. What if there is a 16 or 17 year old person listening to this who is where you were when you saw that documentary, what would you say to them?
Just go for it. Like, follow your sense of motivation, and, you know, if it feels urgent, and it is, like, and also realize that you don't have to know everything. You don't have to be an expert. You can learn things along the way, and just, I think, jumping into something and committing to something sets you on a path where you're going to figure things out, and you're going to, you know, connect with other people and constantly be learning. And it's kind of just surprising how things can come together, even if you're completely starting from scratch.
And I guess one more question is, how much did you know about filmmaking before you started?
Oh, nothing.
So you went from knowing nothing about filmmaking and not knowing a ton about the oceans, but loving them, to making this wonderful film and now making another film. And I mean, you went from zero to extraordinary really quickly.
Thanks. Yeah, basically.
Well, I think that's a model for everybody. And is there anything you want to say about, let's close with a little bit more about either the oceans or deep sea mining. Is there anything else you want to say about either deep sea mining or the oceans?
Just that, you know, deep sea mining is this huge disaster, and we have a very amazing opportunity right now to stop it before it happens, because as soon as that 2-year limit is up and the machines start going out there, you know, it's just going to open the door for so much industry to go in. But if we can shut this down now, it's going to be so much easier than if we try to stop it after it's already underway. So I think this is the time to get involved in preventing deep sea mining from happening. And that is a so worthwhile thing to do.
And 11,000 year old beings are counting on you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for all your great work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Julia Barnes. This is Derek Chentum for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Mm-hmm.